Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 97.
Usually, you know, when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's a certain, I don't know, comfort in the precision of it.
Right, yeah, like it's a known quantity.
Exactly. You break your arm, you go to the hospital, and the x-ray shows that stark, jagged white line. The doctor points to the screen, taps the fracture, and says, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is visible. It's categorized. It's totally binary, right? You're either broken or you're not.
And that binary nature is incredibly reassuring. I mean, it gives us a clear enemy to fight and a clear protocol for healing.
Yeah.
You set the bone, you cast it, you wait. The mechanics of the injury are just entirely contained within the physical body.
But then you step completely outside of that clean clinical framework. You step into the world of profound emotional trauma.
Oh, definitely.
Like deeply rooted family dynamics or systemic manipulation. And suddenly that x-ray machine is just completely useless.
Yeah, it doesn't apply at all.
Yeah. You can't image a broken spirit. You know, you can't take a blood test for a completely shattered reality. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky, where the lines between a physical failing and a psychological collapse are just, they're entirely erased.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
Yeah.
When the environment itself is the pathogen, well, the symptoms manifest in ways that defy simple medical categorization.
Right. Which brings us to the very heart of the source material we are unpacking on today, drawn from chapter 97 of the classic Dream of the Red Chamber.
That's such a heavy chapter.
It really is. So for those of you listening, imagine stepping into this high-stakes aristocratic family drama. But this isn't just a story about a family. It's a story about an institution.
Mm-hmm.
A tragic love triangle, a secret wedding orchestrated in the shadows, and a fatal illness that blurs the line between a broken heart and terminal organ failure.
It really functions as a masterclass in systemic dysfunction. The source material forces us to look directly at the intersection of a severe medical crisis, overwhelming social obligation, and honestly, profound psychological abuse.
Yeah, let me set the scene for you just to establish the sheer weight of the stakes here. We're looking at a sprawling, incredibly wealthy household, the Gia family.
Right.
And it operates more like a small city-state than a modern family, you know. Within this enclosed world, we have three central figures. First, there's Dayu, a young woman who is terminally ill, quite literally wasting away from grief.
Tragic.
Yeah. Second, we have Baiyu, the male heir to this entire empire, who has, for all intents and purposes, completely lost his mind.
Right. His mental state is completely compromised.
Exactly. And third, we have a pragmatic, utterly ruthless family matriarchy. And they're willing to orchestrate a literal bait-and-switch fake wedding to fix the heir while simultaneously isolating and entirely ignoring the dying woman he actually loves.
The sheer mechanics of the deception are staggering. I mean, we're going to examine how an entire network of people, elders, managers, servants, they all collude to create a false reality for one person while actively erasing the existence of another.
Okay, let's really unpack this. Because the sheer psychological manipulation in this text is staggering. The story begins with a physical collapse that is entirely driven by an emotional shock.
Right.
Our source details Dayu inadvertently overhearing a leaked secret. She hears, through the grapevine of the household servants, that Baoyu, the man she has loved her entire life, is officially engaged to another woman, Bao Chai.
And we really need to understand the absolute finality of that rumor for her.
Yeah, it's not just idle gossip.
Not at all. In this highly stratified society, marriage is not about individual choice, right? It's a massive political and economic alliance decided by the elders. Dayu has been living in a state of precarious hope for years. Overhearing this specific secret is not just painful. It's the sudden, violent destruction of her entire anticipated future.
And her reaction is instantaneous. She doesn't just cry. The text says she overhears this. She starts violently coughing up blood, and she completely collapses.
Just a total physical shutdown.
Yeah. And the family doctor is brought in, and the diagnosis he gives is so fascinating. He doesn't say she has tuberculosis or like a standard infection. He diagnoses her with, quote, stagnant ki injuring the liver, causing the liver to fail in storing blood.
To understand the weight of that diagnosis, we have to look at the framework of traditional Chinese medicine operating in this text.
Okay, lay it on us.
Well, in this system, the mind and the body are not separate entities. Emotions are physiological processes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. The liver is the organ responsible for the smooth, unhindered flow of qi or vital energy and blood throughout the body. When a person experiences massive, unexpressed emotional trauma, like profound grief or the forced repression of forbidden love, that energy stops moving. It stagnates.
Wait, so the emotion literally becomes a physical blockage?
Precisely. Her inability to freely express her love for Baoyu, combined with the sudden shock of this betrayal, creates a catastrophic stagnation. The trapped grief injures the liver.
Oh, wow.
Because the liver can no longer perform its function of storing and regulating blood, the blood rebels. It moves recklessly upwards, which is why she's coughing it up. The doctor is looking at a physical hemorrhage, but he's diagnosing an emotional implosion.
Her heartbreak is not a metaphor here.
Exactly. It's an acute, fatal organ failure.
But here's the part that really trips me up. The second Dayu wakes up from this total physical collapse, the panic is just, it's gone. She's completely placid.
It's eerie.
Very. You'd expect her to be hysterical, screaming, demanding answers, but she is eerily calm. Sure. She looks at her terrified maids and calmly tells them she only desires a swift death to, quote, repay this debt.
Wait, why does the certainty of the bad news actually calm her down? It's almost like the anxiety of not knowing was worse than the death sentence itself.
That's a profound psychological shift, and it aligns perfectly with how the human nervous system processes prolonged ambiguity. How so?
Well, when you're trapped in a state of absolute uncertainty, wondering if the elders will approve your marriage, wondering if the man you love will be given to someone else, your nervous system is locked in a sympathetic state. It's constantly firing.
Right.
You're running these exhausting internal simulations trying to predict the future and protect yourself.
You're basically constantly bracing for an impact that hasn't happened yet.
Yes. And the moment that ambiguity is removed, even if the news is catastrophic, the brain no longer has to run those simulations. The threat is no longer a possibility. It's a reality.
Oh, I see.
For Dayu, the fight-or-flight response entirely shuts down because the battle is definitively over.
Yeah.
She lost. Her body enters a parasympathetic state of collapse, basically a deep freeze.
It's a conscious surrender.
It is the only form of agency she has left. The social structure has completely denied her the life she wanted, so she's reclaiming control over the only thing remaining, how she exits that world. Her desire for a swift death is a rejection of the environment that made her sick in the first place.
And the isolation she experiences in this moment of surrender is just chilling. We have to look at the people immediately surrounding her loyal maids, Purple Cuckoo, also known as Zihuan, and Snow Goose.
Right.
You have this young woman lying in bed, actively coughing up blood, calmly asking for death. And her maids are weeping, but the text makes it clear they are terrified.
You're terrified of the management.
Yes. Not just of her dying, but of getting in trouble with the household management. Specifically, they're afraid of a woman named Wang Shifeng, the ruthless general manager of the estate. The maids are terrified of being punished for making a fuss.
It's unbelievable.
Think about the reality of that. You're watching your closest friend and mistress bleed to death, and your primary overriding fear is a middle management reprimand for being too loud about it.
It perfectly illustrates the suffocating nature of this aristocratic ecosystem. In the Jia household, the smooth, aesthetic operation of the estate supersedes basic human compassion. The maids understand the brutal calculus of their world. They know that if they disrupt the household's superficial order with messy, unpleasant things like grief and dying, they'll face severe physical or economic punishment.
The system demands absolute silence.
It demands that the aesthetic of prosperity be maintained at all costs. Empathy in this environment is a dangerous liability.
Which makes the next event even more devastating. This massive physical collapse finally triggers a visit from the highest authority in the house, the matriarch, Jia Mother.
You'd think this would be a tender moment.
Right. If you're reading this like a standard narrative, you assume this is the moment of grace, the grandmother coming to the dying girl's bedside to offer comfort. But her reaction is the exact opposite.
It's brutal.
Jia Mother looks at Dayu, assesses the situation, and makes a shocking pivot. Instead of offering sympathy, she concludes that Dayu's illness is a heart sickness.
And we really need to dissect that term carefully. Heart sickness, when spoken by the ultimate authority figure in a Neo-Confucian household, is a highly loaded accusation.
It's not a medical term.
No, it does not mean cardiovascular disease. It means an inappropriate, unsanctioned, romantic fixation. Jia Mother is diagnosing Dayu with a moral failure.
She is essentially saying, you are dying because you love someone you aren't supposed to love. DU Mother actually explicitly states that if DU harbors other thoughts, these unapproved romantic desires, then she has, quote, loved her for nothing.
Yeah.
She flat out refuses to spend any more family money to cure her. I read that line and my jaw dropped. It is so utterly cold.
It is perhaps the most brutal articulation of the social contract in the entire text.
Yeah.
It reveals the absolute conditionality of aristocratic love. We tend to view familial love as unconditional, but in this world, love, care, and medical resources from your elders are strictly conditional upon your perfect obedience to social rules.
It feels exactly like a corporate sponsorship. I mean, imagine a massive brand sponsoring a star athlete. The athlete gets the money, the prestige, the protection of the brand. But the contract has a strict morality clause. The moment the athlete does something publicly embarrassing, something that violates the brand's core values, the corporation immediately pulls all funding. They disavow the athlete completely. Gia Mother just looked at Dayu, decided she violated the family morality clause, and canceled her.
The corporate analogy holds up perfectly because the aristocratic family operates precisely like a corporation. The primary directive is the survival and reputation of the family brand.
Mm-hmm.
Individual emotional needs are not just secondary. They are actively dangerous if they threaten the established order. The matriarch doesn't care about Dayu's physical pain. She cares that Dayu's pain is rooted in a desire that bypasses the elder's authority.
Wow.
The moment Dayu's private feelings cross into that forbidden territory, she ceases to be a beloved granddaughter and becomes a toxic liability.
So they just write her off. They leave her to die. And immediately, the management structure of the family pivots to the real emergency. They have a broken asset that needs fixing by you.
The male heir.
Right. He is the future of the family corporation, and he is currently suffering from a severe, debilitating mental breakdown. Wang Xifeng, the ruthless manager we mentioned earlier, steps in with a solution. She suggests they rush Bao Yu's marriage to Bao Chai, the other young woman in the triangle. And she wants to use a specific traditional strategy called Changshi to cure his madness.
The concept of Changshi is deeply ingrained in the cultural fabric of the time. It translates roughly to warding off evil with joy.
So interesting.
It's the practice of arranging a massive, highly auspicious event, almost always a wedding, to counteract extreme bad luck, chronic illness, or in this case, mental collapse.
So it's basically the idea that a sufficiently loud, happy party can frighten away a disease.
It goes deeper than just cheering someone up, actually. It's rooted in a cosmological belief in balancing energies. The family believes that the overwhelming positive yang energy of a wedding, and specifically the introduction of a new, healthy bride into the heir's life, can act as a mystical shock to his system.
A shock to the system.
Exactly. They believe this influx of highly concentrated, auspicious energy will overwhelm the dark, stagnant energy causing his delirium.
It's literally prescribing a human being, a bride, as medicine. But there's a massive logistical problem. Before they can spring this trap and arrange the wedding, they have to figure out if the groom is even fundamentally lucid enough to participate.
Right, you can't marry a catatonic person.
Exactly. So, Xifeng takes it upon herself to visit Baiyu and test his sanity. She walks into his room, looks him right in the eye, and tells him he is going to marry Lin Meimei, which is Dayu's intimate nickname. She lies to his face just to see if he can process the information.
The way Baiyu responds to this lie is incredibly complex, and it highlights the vast chasm between his internal reality and Xifeng's external pragmatism.
Mm.
Baiyu laughs. He insists he isn't stupid. And then he tells her that he already gave his heart to Lin Meimei.
And Xifeng listens to him, and her reaction is fascinating. She realizes he is speaking absolute nonsense, like he's talking about his heart literally leaving his body. But she notes that physically, he is acting lucid enough to be manipulated.
Right.
He can stand up, he responds to prompts, he understands the basic concept of a wedding, and she essentially concludes, okay, good enough. Here's where it gets really interesting. Xifeng knows he's essentially delirious, but as long as he can stand up and follow directions, she considers him sane enough for a wedding. Is she willfully ignorant or just fiercely pragmatic?
She is the ultimate pragmatist, but that pragmatism creates a severe blind spot. Xifeng operates entirely on logistical intelligence, but she has zero emotional intelligence.
Oh, that makes sense.
She thinks Baiyu's obsession with Dayu is just a mechanical lever she can pull. Because she herself does not understand the concept of profound soul-level devotion, she assumes Baiyu's madness is just a stubborn fixation. She treats his spiritual connection to Dayu as a mere logistical hurdle that can be bypassed with a clever riddle and a trick.
It is so tragic because Baiyu is not speaking in riddles. He is telling her the absolute literal truth of his internal state. He has this incredibly haunting line in the text. He looks at Xi Feng and says, "I have a heart. I already gave it to Lin Mei Mei the other day. If she comes over, she'll bring it back to me and put it in my stomach."
This specific line forces us to examine how madness is defined within this narrative.
Yeah.
To Xi Feng and to the rest of the household management, that statement is pure gibberish. It's proof that he's broken.
But to him.
To Baiyu, it's the most accurate possible description of his emotional reality.
Yeah.
He has entirely externalized his soul. He's given the core of his being to Daiyu. Without her, he is quite literally an empty vessel.
He feels hollowed out.
Exactly. But Xi Feng hears this profound confession of spiritual emptiness and just thinks, great, as long as he believes Daiyu is walking through that door, he will stand at the altar and perform the ritual. She weaponizes his devotion against him.
So Xi Feng has theoretically secured the groom through deception. The Jia family has a plan. But, you know, a wedding requires two families. They need the bride's family, the Xu family, to sign off on this.
Right.
They need them to agree to a rushed, highly secretive wedding, marrying their daughter to a man who is clearly not in his right mind. Why would any powerful family agree to that?
This introduces one of the most cynical, transactional subplots in the entire narrative. To get the agreement, the Jia family brings in Aunt Xu, the mother of the intended bride, Bao Chai.
And the text reveals the leverage the Jia family is holding. Aunt Xu has a son, Xu Pan, who is Bao Chai's older brother. And Xu Pan is currently embroiled in a massive manslaughter case.
A very serious charge.
Very. He has essentially killed a man and is facing execution, or at the very least, severe life-destroying punishment. The Jia family approaches Aunt Xu and offers a deal. They promise to use their immense political power to tear up the lawsuit, manipulate the local magistrates, and provide the massive ransom money needed to save her son's life.
But there's a catch.
A huge catch. The price of this intervention is that Aunt Xu must immediately agree to marry her daughter into the Jia family under these bizarre, disrespectful conditions.
It is the ultimate plea deal. We are looking at the raw mechanics of socioeconomic justice in this era, where the law is entirely malleable if you have the right aristocratic backing. But that backing demands blood in return.
Wow.
Bao Chai is the collateral in this transaction. She is being traded to save her brother from execution and simultaneously to fulfill her family's overarching duty to maintain the alliance with the far more powerful Jia network.
We talk so much about Daiyu's tragedy, the coughing blood, the isolation, but isn't Bao Chai a victim here too?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, she's highly intelligent, highly capable, and she is being forced into a marriage with a clinically insane man under the guise of an emergency medical ritual, all to pay off her brother's manslaughter debt.
She is absolutely a victim, but her tragedy is characterized by suffocating silence rather than vocal despair. When Bai Chai is informed of the arrangement, when she realizes she's to be married under these deeply humiliating terms, the text notes that she retreats to her room and weeps silently.
She doesn't scream, she doesn't break furniture, she doesn't confront her mother.
Because she cannot. Daiyu has the luxury, if you can call it that, of illness, which allows her to outwardly manifest her trauma. Bao Chai is bound by the ironclad rules of filial piety. The moral code of her society demands absolute, unquestioning compliance to her elders' decisions.
Right.
She possesses immense clarity. She knows exactly what she's walking into. She knows Baiyu doesn't love her. She knows his mind is compromised, and she knows she's being used as a pawn in a legal payoff.
But she just cries quietly in her room, and then she dries her tears and accepts her fate. It's a completely different texture of tragedy than Daiyu's, but it's just as agonizing. It's the tragedy of perfect obedience.
Very well put.
So, the horrific deal is struck. The two powerful families are aligned. But the Jia family knows that if Daiyu finds out about the wedding, the shock will kill her immediately, which would ruin the auspicious energy of the Changshi ritual. You can't have a funeral and a wedding in the same house at the same time.
The logistics of keeping this secret require an immense coordinated effort. The family goes to extreme lengths to manipulate the physical space of the estate.
They literally route the heavy ceremonial wedding gifts through the back gardens, using obscure pathways to completely avoid Daiyu's courtyard. They have hundreds of servants essentially tiptoeing around a dying woman, creating a massive vacuum of silence around her just so they can finalize a business transaction.
This physical and informational isolation is what finally breaks Daiyu's spirit. She's entirely cut off from the daily rhythm of the household. The sudden, deafening silence around her is more terrifying than any rumor. It's the silence of abandonment.
And that profound isolation leads us to the absolute emotional climax of the source text. It is a scene that is incredibly difficult to process.
It's devastating.
Dayu's lying in bed. The house is strangely quiet. No one is visiting her. The matriarchs have vanished. She realizes with terrifying clarity that she has been utterly abandoned. She forces her physically failing body to sit up in bed, and she asks her maid for two very specific things: her poetry manuscript and an old white silk handkerchief with writing on it.
We have to pause and consider the immense symbolic weight of these two objects. In this heavily restricted world, these are not mere possessions. They are the physical manifestations of her inner life, her intellect, and her soul.
She's so weak that she cannot even tear the paper or the silk. The text details how violently her hands are shaking. She can't destroy them with her own physical strength. So she orders her maid, Snow Goose, to light a brazier, a small fire next to the bed, and Dayu slowly, agonizingly, throws the items into the flames.
The act of burning these specific items is profound. The white silk handkerchief was a private, highly subversive token of forbidden love given to her by Bayou, and the poems were her voice.
Her only way to express herself.
Right. In a society where women are granted very little public presence, poetry is the only acceptable avenue for a woman to express her genius, her sorrow, and her internal landscape. By burning them, she's enacting a deliberate self-erasure.
It's like someone deleting all their photos, wiping their hard drive, and burning their diaries before they pass away. She's saying, if I can't have this reality, I'm taking the evidence of my heart with me.
It is a desperate, ultimate assertion of control. The family stripped away her future, so she retaliates by destroying her past. And the physical agony of the scene amplifies the emotional violence. She is burning her own legacy while her body is actively shutting down.
It's just so dark.
And we cannot ignore the reaction of her maids. Purple Cuckoo wants desperately to stop her. She sees her mistress destroying her most prized possessions, but she's too afraid of the strict household rules to physically intervene.
Wow, yeah.
She can't grab the burning silk from the fire because to do so would be an unacceptable breach of servant protocol.
Purple Cuckoo is paralyzed by the system. She just has to stand there watching the smoke rise, watching her friend effectively commit suicide of the soul. And while Dayu is systematically unmaking herself in this quiet, smoky room, Purple Cuckoo finally leaves to look for help. And that is when she discovers the horrifying truth of what is happening just across the compound.
The contrast the narrative builds here is incredibly jarring. In one isolated courtyard, a woman is quietly erasing herself from the world in the presence of a small fire. In another part of the estate, a massive, noisy, theatrical deception is hitting its crescendo.
Purple Cuckoo runs to the matriarch's rooms, expecting to find Jia, mother, or Shifeng, but the rooms are totally empty. She eventually corners a young servant boy, and he spills the secret. He tells her that Baoyu is marrying right now, in a newly prepared, highly decorated house on the estate.
What a shock that must have been.
Right. Purple Cuckoo is instantly consumed by rage. She believes Bayou has orchestrated this. She thinks his heart is as cold as ice and snow to abandon Dayu like this while she's literally coughing up her last breaths.
The tragic irony of Purple Cuckoo's rage is fascinating. She hates Bayou in this specific moment, entirely unaware that Bayou is a victim of the exact same systemic deception. He's being manipulated just as brutally as Dayu is being ignored.
Purple Cuckoo actually vows that Baoyu will have no face to see her after his wish-fulfilling wedding. How does this systemic deception weaponize the grief of the servants?
Abusive systems survive by compartmentalizing truth. By keeping the reality of the fake wedding completely hidden, the family elders ensure that the collateral damage, the younger generation, and the servants direct their anger at each other, rather than at the architects of the pain.
Oh, that's so sinister.
Purple Cuckoo's righteous anger is entirely valid, but the system has manipulated her into aiming it at the wrong target. Gayu is not the villain here. He's another prisoner in the matriarch's play.
And amidst all the secret rushing around, the misdirected anger, the whispered rumors, there is exactly one moment of genuine, unsullied mourning for Dayu. A woman named Li Wan visits the dying girl.
The sister-in-law?
Yes. Li Wan is the widowed sister-in-law of the family. She comes into the room, sees Dayu fading away, and openly weeps over her unmatched beauty and talent. She compares Dayu to the goddess of frost, acknowledging the sheer ethereal brilliance that is being extinguished.
Li Wan's presence in this scene is crucial. As a widow in this society, her social position is fixed. She's no longer part of the marriage market, and she is largely removed from the immediate political machinations of the estate.
So she's outside the game.
Exactly. She represents traditional, austere virtue, but because she is politically sidelined, she possesses the clarity to see the true tragedy of what's being lost. Her tears are the only honest emotional response to Dai's impending death in the entire sprawling household.
But even this one pure moment of mourning is violently interrupted by the chilling logistical needs of the family's deception. While Dai is actively drawing her last breaths, a manager's wife arrives at the courtyard. And she doesn't just come to prepare funeral arrangements. She comes to borrow Snow Goose, Dai's other maid.
This is the pivot to the ultimate decoy. This is the moment the deception graduates from merely withholding information to active, devastating psychological manipulation.
They need Snow Goose for a very specific reason. Remember, they've convinced the delirious Bao Yu that he's marrying Dai Yu, but Bao Yu's mind is fractured. He might panic. So they dress Snow Goose up in formal attire and send her to the secret wedding.
It's so twisted.
When Bao Yu stands at the altar and looks through the haze of his madness, he sees Snow Goose Dai Yu's personal, lifelong maid standing right next to the heavily veiled bride. His broken mind latches onto this familiar pop and logically concludes, well, Snow Goose is standing there, so the woman under the veil must be Dai Yu.
It is an incredibly cruel exploitation of his cognitive state. They understand that his mind can't process complex reality, so they feed it a highly recognizable data point to force it to output the desired behavior. They use his familiar associations against him.
So, what does this all mean? It's like a terrifying theatrical production where the lead actor is the only one who doesn't have the real script. They use a familiar prop, Snow Goose, to keep him hitting his marks on stage. And the most horrifying part is, it actually works. Temporarily, at least.
The power of belief is extraordinary here. Believing that his lifelong dream is finally coming true, Bayou's spirit physically strengthens. It's an extreme manifestation of the placebo effect.
Right.
The text notes that he goes through all the elaborate, noisy, exhausting traditional wedding rituals with renewed vigor. He bows to the heavens. He bows to the elders. He performs the entire ceremony. The matriarchy's chanchi strategy appears on the surface to be a complete resounding success.
He believes he's being healed by love, when in reality he's being managed by logistics. But then comes the moment of the reveal. The elaborate ceremony ends, the guests leave, the room clears out, and Bayou is finally alone in the bridal chamber.
The tension here is unbearable.
He approaches the bed. He lifts the heavy red veil. He expects to see Dai Yu, the ethereal, fragile love of his life. But instead, he sees Bao Chai. She is in full bridal makeup. The text describes her appearance as lotus powder grouping with dew. It's an image of heavy, opulent, overwhelming physical beauty, which is the exact opposite of Dai's sickly spiritual nature.
The absolute cognitive dissonance of that moment is staggering to consider. He's staring directly at physical reality, but that reality completely contradicts both the reality he was explicitly promised by his family and the fragile reality his broken mind had constructed to survive.
He cannot process what he is seeing. He literally rubs his eyes. He asks for the lamp to be brought closer to the bed. He thinks he's trapped in a dream. He turns to his maid and asks, who is this? He asks, where is Lin Mei Ming? Where is Snow Goose? He is desperately searching for the anchor they just ripped away from him.
You have to wonder about the family's ultimate endgame here. What did Wang Xifeng and Jia Mother actually think was going to happen when he lifted the veil? Did they truly believe the momentum of the wedding would force him to just shrug and accept the switch?
That's the most chilling part. Their response when his mind inevitably starts to break again is so revealing. When he starts questioning reality, they don't sit him down and explain the logic of the alliance. They don't apologize for the deception.
No, of course not.
Wang Xifeng just issues a sharp warning, telling him not to offend his new bride. And then, when his confusion turns to physical agitation, they literally light calming incense in the room to knock him out.
When psychological manipulation reaches its limit, they resort to chemical sedation. They gaslight him, telling him his reality is wrong, and then they sedate him to force compliance.
Unbelievable.
The deception is complete, the marriage is finalized, the legal alliance with the Thu family is secured, and the ritual has been performed. But the consequences of this intense psychological violence are just beginning to manifest.
Which brings us to the morning after and the final sequence of our source text. The sun comes up on this newly shattered reality. And the narrative shifts focus to Jia Zheng Baiyu's father. Jia Zheng is preparing to depart for a long-term official government post far away from the capital.
Jia Zheng is a vital component of this machine. He represents the overarching patriarchal authority, the imperial order, and the public face of the family. And crucially, He has been kept largely oblivious to the true messy nature of Bayou's illness and the absolute cruelty of the deception the matriarchs just pulled off.
He is the audience they have been performing this entire elaborate play for. Before he leaves, Bayou is essentially paraded out to say goodbye to his father. And Bayou, despite the catastrophic trauma of the previous night, manages to pull himself together just long enough to act lucid.
Right.
He bows, he says the appropriate words, he perfectly performs the role of the dutiful, respectful son.
It highlights the overarching theme of performative duty that governs the society. Survival in this family requires you to perform your role flawlessly, regardless of your internal state.
Even if you're falling apart.
Exactly. Bayou is required to suppress his completely shattered reality in order to perform filial piety for his father's departure. The external ritual must be observed, even if the internal structure is entirely hollow.
And Jia Zhang, looking down at his son, a young man who's literally only held together by heavy sedation and fresh trauma, turns to his wife and tells her to ensure Bayou studies diligently for the civil service exams next year. I have to ask, is Jia Zhang genuinely that blind to his son's condition? Or is it just incredibly convenient for him to ignore a crumbling household as long as the rituals are observed and everyone smiles for the camera?
It is the epitome of willful blindness. He just wants to see his heir standing upright, ready to take the exams and secure the family's future prestige. It is a searing indictment of a society that values the appearance of success over actual human flourishing.
And the moment the audience is gone, the very second Jia Zhang gets in his carriage and leaves the estate, the illusion completely collapses. Bayou returns to his room, and his old illness violently returns tenfold. He becomes entirely comatose.
The body just gives up.
He's unable to eat. His mind completely irreparably breaks under the crushing weight of the previous night's drama. The matriarchs have solved their immediate logistical problem of securing the marriage, but they have utterly destroyed both of their heirs in the process. Dayu is dead in her isolated courtyard, and Bayu's mind is gone.
The system consumed its own children to preserve itself. The physical house is still standing, the crucial marriage alliance is legally secured, but the soul of the family has been entirely irrevocably hollowed out.